When is waste not waste? That's a question we are looking to answer in this edition of the World Nuclear News Podcast. I'm Alex Hunt, and I've been talking to Professor Tim Tinsley about pioneering work he's involved in, getting life-saving cancer treatments and fuel for spacecraft from the UK's stockpile of radioactive material.
We've got a number of projects, one looking at space exploration and providing power and heat on spacecraft using material that we can extract from legacy material. And the other aspect is looking at new treatments for cancer using, again, material, radionuclides extracted from legacy material. So two very different kind of applications, but fundamentally are exactly the same in that you're extracting something that has occurred in a legacy material. You're doing that with some form of chemistry, radiochemical processing, and you're turning something that would probably end up in a hole in the ground at some point in the future into something that offers considerable value in another sector.
More from Professor Tinsley later, but first, the inaugural Nuclear Energy Summit, co-organised by the International Atomic Energy Agency and Belgium, was held in Brussels in March, and feature the leaders and senior representatives of more than 30 countries gathering to put the case for an expansion of nuclear energy in the years ahead. Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo opened the event.
For Belgium, today's gathering is about accelerating our collective path to climate neutrality. Every day, in every corner of the globe, the consequences of climate change are becoming increasingly visible. We cannot waste any time when it comes to fighting global warming. The challenge we face is enormous. It will require vast, safe, and reliable amounts of carbon neutral energy. It will require a perspective for sustainable growth. It will require us to have our citizens and industries on board. It will require nuclear energy as part of the mix.
International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said it had taken 70 years for a nuclear energy conference featuring national leaders to take place.
When we meet at this level of leaders, it's not to celebrate or simply to commemorate something, it's to think about how to do it better and how to do it right. And this is why I'm very proud to say that all the participants from all over the world, reunited here in Brussels, have agreed on a declaration that addresses these points. This declaration addresses all these points, but also focuses on what we still need to do in order to facilitate, to make possible that this promise, that this factor, that the nuclear factor is there in the right way. And what we have in mind here, of course, is aspects that are very, very concrete, very tangible, like the financing, for example. And we know that still we do have, or we do not have, rather, a level playing field when it comes to integrating nuclear. We still have an international financial institutions and architecture that in some cases, even today, prevents, forbids financing of nuclear projects.
The issue of financing was one which was raised by a number of those taking part, including calls for the European Investment Bank to get involved in funding new nuclear. At one of the panel discussions later, a bank representative stressed that its shareholders were the EU member states, which are split at the moment on the issue of nuclear energy. Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, began her speech by acknowledging different views within the European Union before focusing on the technological possibilities of small modular reactors.
As everyone is aware, there are different views across the European Union on nuclear power. But I am here because I believe that in countries that are open to the technology, nuclear technology can play an important role in the clean energy transition. Then there is, of course, also the issue of lifetime extensions for existing nuclear plants, provided, of course, they are safe operations. Given the urgency of the climate challenge, countries need to consider their options carefully before they forego a readily available source of low-emission electricity. Extending the safe operation of today's nuclear fleet is one of the cheapest ways to secure clean power at scale, so it can help pave a cost-effective path to net zero. And of course, as with every emerging technology, there are ups and downs, successes and failures. That is quite normal. But SMRs are a promising technology, and there is a race underway. The race is among leading countries and companies to prove this technology and bring it to the market. More than 80 projects around the world are moving forward, and several of our member states have expressed a strong interest in SMRs. So let's go for it. So to conclude, I leave you with these four tasks. Invest now in climate neutrality 2050. Broaden your engagement with clean energy transition. Consider the extending of lifetimes of existing plants with full commitment to the highest level of safety, and innovate. If the industry and governments can deliver on these tasks, then I can see a way forward for nuclear power to make a significant contribution to a rapid, safe, and secure net zero future.
Another message heard at the conference was about the impact of geopolitics, with a Chinese representative, Vice Premier Zhang Guoqing, saying there was a need to oppose politicisation of the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. Here's Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, whose country is embarked on the Russian-built Paks II nuclear power plant project.
According to the current state of play, a new capacity of 2,400 megawatt will be connected to the grid during the beginning of the next decade. This will enable us to avoid imports of 3.5 billion cubic meters of natural gas every year, and our annual CO2 emission will be decreased by 17 million tons, which equals 1.5 times more than the emission of the entire Hungarian transportation sector, and 3 times more compared to what all our forests in Hungary can digest. We are happy to note that regardless of the geopolitical difficulties, a wide range international, professional and scientific cooperation still exists on the field of nuclear energy. A number of American, German, French, Swedish, Swiss and even Austrian subcontractors are working together with the Russian constructors on our nuclear expansion project. It is the interest of all of us to prevent nuclear energy to become hostage of geopolitical conflicts, hypocrisy and ideological debates.
The European Union's biggest producer of nuclear energy is France. Here's a taster of what its President Emmanuel Macron said.
I think this is a very important moment because collectively we embody definitely this alliance of strength and willingness to do much more for climate, economies, and with business leaders, researchers, and so on, to build new solutions. Our challenge is to deliver on climate change and reduce our CO2 emissions, is to improve our sovereignty by securing our energy, and it's to improve our competitiveness in order to create jobs at the same time. And it's true for all the regions of the planet being present here in this room. If you want to reconcile these three objectives, you need the relevant and consistent energy approach. Let me say that we can electrify our mobility, but if the electricity is produced with fossil fuel, it's a stupid move.
The next COP climate change summit is due to take place in Azerbaijan, and Foreign Minister Ceyhun Bayramov said nuclear energy was prominent in its thoughts.
The inclusion of nuclear energy in the global stocktake at COP28 as a means for reductions in greenhouse gas emissions was indeed a historic milestone. This development is a testament to the progress made collectively in ensuring the safety and security of nuclear energy and highlights the instrumental role of the IAEA. The IAEA steps focusing on the environment impacts of nuclear energy, most notably the Atoms for Climate initiative, are commendable and deserve our full support. As we explore expanded use of nuclear energy, it is imperative that we redouble our efforts in addressing nuclear safety. Moreover, facilitating affordable access to nuclear technologies for peaceful purposes should remain a cornerstone of our collective endeavor. We, as the host country for COP29, are committed to spearheading efforts to produce tangible outcomes at this milestone event to be held in Baku later this year. Ensuring the inclusion of facilitated and affordable nuclear energy technologies in the resource deliberations of the COP process is essential.
The final declaration was signed by 32 countries. See the show notes for a link to read it in full. And the conference co-hosts concluded the event by looking forward to another such summit being held in the coming years. I'm delighted now to be joined by Professor Tim Tinsley. He's Professor of Space Nuclear Power at University of Leicester and also Account Director for Space and Radioisotopes at the National Nuclear Laboratory in the UK. Hello, Professor Tinsley, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Before we get stuck into the main topic of our discussion today, can you tell us a bit about your background and your current role?
Yes, certainly. I'm actually a chemical engineer by trade. I graduated back in 1992 and have been working up at the Sellafield site in West Cumbria since then, so just over 31 years now, in the essentially the R&D, the research department of the business up here. The business has changed as I've been up here. It was originally British Nuclear Fuels, and then the National Nuclear Laboratory was split out of that back in the early 2000s.
So to start with the basics, your role involves projects to look at recycling used nuclear fuel and other radioactive waste. Is that correct?
Yes, I've spent pretty much my entire career dissolving things and separating things in the nuclear world. Originally, it was used nuclear fuel, looking at reprocessing scenarios. But more recently, I'm looking at some of the interesting legacy materials and waste that's stored in the UK and identifying opportunities where we can derive value from them by extracting isotopes or nuclides material from them that then can be reused rather than disposed of as waste.
For the many people who have never seen radioactive waste, what exactly are we talking about?
It can be pretty much anything. And I try to avoid calling them waste as well. I try to term them as legacy materials. They may become waste, but until you actually throw them away, they're not effectively wastes. And those materials can be nice, homogeneous powders or material. They can be metals. They can be, at the opposite end, they can be collections of debris dug out of a sump or a drain in a nuclear facility. So they can be everything from really, really good, well understood material to literally stuff that's been dug up and put in a drum.
And the majority of it is used fuel?
The majority of it has come from used fuel and reactors, but generally it's not the used fuel that I'm currently interested in with the projects we're looking at. We generally are looking at things that have become a product of used fuel, i.e. they've gone through some form of reprocessing or degradation and material has been separated out of that used fuel.
The UK has got quite a unique history of reprocessing, hasn't it?
Yeah, we've had a fun time in the UK since the 1950s with a range of reactors and reprocessing technology that's been deployed.
What sort of things have been done?
You know, the UK was actually right at the forefront of things like medical isotope back in the 50s and 60s. We had a range of research and experimental reactors in the UK, over 40 at one point. We had capability down at Harwell and up at Sellafield and at other sites. And we were able to irradiate a lot of different materials to produce isotopes that can be used for other purposes. We've also operated three reprocessing plants big reprocessing plants in the UK over the decades. And so I've got quite a unique history in terms of irradiation and radiochemical separations work.
So there are some very exciting possibilities emerging at the moment.
Well, I certainly think they're exciting. We've got a number of projects, one looking at space exploration and providing power and heat on spacecraft using material that we can extract from legacy material. And the other aspect is looking at new treatments for cancer using, again, radionuclides extracted from legacy material. So two very different kind of applications, but fundamentally are exactly the same in that you're extracting something that has occurred in a legacy material. You're doing that with some form of chemistry, radiochemical processing, and you're turning something that would probably end up in a hole in the ground at some point in the future into something that offers considerable value in another sector.
And what sort of scale are we talking about? When you say this is material that would have otherwise ended up in a hole in the ground, what proportion would you say of that material do you think is recyclable in this way?
At the projects we're looking at the moment, it's a very, very small percentage of the legacy material. We're not going to suddenly find a use for all of the legacy material that the UK has and that's under the stewardship of the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. Treatments for cancer, etc., you're talking about tiny, tiny amounts of material as opposed to the kilograms and ton quantities that are in store awaiting disposal. So at the moment, we haven't identified we don't have a project that is going to make a noticeable dent in the inventory material for disposal. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have considerable value when you look at what you're able to do then in those other sectors, be it treating cancer or powering spacecraft.
And how difficult is the process to get the good stuff from the legacy material?
It can be incredibly difficult. You've really got three aspects that you have to worry about. The legacy material itself can be really difficult to access. It could be in a store that isn't designed for retrieving material routinely. It could be in the bottom of a storage pond. It's typically contaminated with other radioactive material, so it will be difficult to handle from a radiation and possibly difficult to handle from a chemical hazard point of view. So you've got to get access to the material itself, and you need facilities to be able to do that. The radiochemistry then on extracting the radionuclides can be very difficult, depending on how complicated the material is. It means that you might need some quite advanced and complex chemistry. And then the final part of the puzzle is you've then got to get that material to its place of use. And again, that can be a challenge. You've got to get it off a nuclear license site. You've got to be able to prove the quality and the cleanliness of that material, especially if it's going into a clinical environment. And so you've got that part of the challenge as well. So there's really those three aspects that have to be worried about: getting access to material, getting the material out, and then being able to prove its quality and pedigree.
An alternative option to get this material is to construct a specific facility. How does that option compare?
That is essentially the traditional way of doing that. And if you look around globally, and actually if you look in the UK historically, that is what's been done. So the likes of ANSTO, NRG, in the Netherlands, for example, the US have quite extensive programs where they are irradiating material and making the isotope. What we're proposing here is really twofold. We don't have to make it. It's already there. So that, in theory, removes a lot of the cost because you don't need a reactor, you don't need an irradiation capability. The second thing is it's a more sustainable thing to do as well. If the material is already there, rather than throw it away, it's much better to recycle and reuse it and have that societal impact as well. It doesn't mean that we don't need a radiation capability to make things, but where we've got the material already in existence, it is better, in my view, to go after that rather than make new and more material.
I was at the discussion you took part in at the most recent IAEA General Conference, And it was interesting to hear at that the relevant UK government department and the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority both speaking in positive tones about this sort of work, but also referencing the need for a political decision to be taken before it could happen on a permanent or bigger scale. And I see there have been some grants announced since that event.
Yes, so it's fair to say we are taking the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority and the relevant government departments on a journey here. The focus, quite rightly, over the last little decade or so since the NDA was set up legally, has been on understanding and managing the UK's nuclear legacy, making sure it's safe and preparing for eventual disposal. So that has been the primary focus. So for us to kind of come along and say, well, hold on a minute, before you throw that away and in your nice planned way that you've done that, there may be some value we can extract at that. We're having to kind of take people on the journey that actually that is worth doing, rather than the impact that that might have on the decommissioning program. So that is a really important consideration, and I believe was evident in the presentations from Nuclear Decommissioning Authority and government at the IAEA event. You're also quite right, the Department for Energy Security Net Zero were successful in obtaining some funds during the last spending review for a medical radionuclide innovation program, which they called MRIP, and they've allocated 10 successful bids against the fund that they had, of which NNL was successful on 3 of our bids. So we're very grateful and pleased with the outcome of that. And we're very pleased to see Department of Energy Security Net Zero really embracing this idea of obtaining value from legacy material as a complement to decommissioning strategies.
So I guess the first step is to demonstrate the feasibility of this process and the potential benefits of it. But there's also got to be some sort of financial case put for it as well, I'm guessing, from a government decision-making point of view.
Yes, our programs of work that we have really follow those two parallel tracks. There's the lab work, the chemistry, the modelling to evaluate the best way to essentially run the flow sheet, the chemistry of the separation, etc. And then in parallel, there's the business case justification for the work. So looking at what the market might be, looking at the cost of obtaining the material and separating it, looking at the potential competition that might exist globally for this material. And quite often, that side of things is, in a lot of ways, harder than the chemistry. The chemistry is what we're comfortable with. We've got, in NNL, we have a lot of very highly qualified and experienced radiochemists and nuclear physicists that this is their bread and butter, as it were. And the work from that side of things is a good technical challenge. The business case side of things, especially where market might not yet be defined because you're talking about potentially new treatments rather than existing treatments or new ways to power spacecraft, etc., means that business case can actually be quite difficult to pin down and need a certain amount of leap of faith to make it happen.
You mentioned earlier it was a very small proportion of the legacy material that you were considering extracting. But in terms of patient treatments and space, how big an impact are we talking about?
If I can kind of split the two, for space power, traditionally, the US and the Russians have provided heat and power on spacecraft using nuclear systems. The likes of the Voyager probe, Cassini, the Mars rovers are all powered by a nuclear system on board. We quite locally call them space batteries, but they're not batteries in this truest sense. And they use an isotope of plutonium called plutonium-238 that has to be made and manufactured. And the Americans are doing that. Because of the cost of those types of that isotope and the complexity of launch, we see those systems used maybe 2 or 3 times a decade. So really for the very flagship kind of missions. So the scale that we're looking at for our systems, which will be powered by an isotope called americium-241, that's very similar to plutonium-238, but doesn't have to be made. It exists in the UK legacy material, is of that kind of order of maybe a few units a decade. And those units may contain a kilogram or so of americium. So pretty small quantities from an inventory point of view. On the medicine side, the quantities are, as I said, are tiny. You clearly can't put a lot of nuclear material into a human because it clearly does them a lot of damage. So there's a technique called targeted radiotherapies where you essentially smuggle the radioisotope, the radionuclide, into the cancer cell as like a Trojan horse by connecting it to something that the cancer preferentially attracts. And that way you can inject a tiny amount of nuclear material into a human and it seeks out the cancers and then irradiates the cancers, the cancer cells and just the cancer cells. That's tiny amounts of material. And even if you scale that up to, you know, thousands of treatments per year across the UK, you're still talking about sub-gram quantities of actual isotope that you need. So a very, very different scale to the kind of 1,000-ton per year reprocessing plant that was operated at Thorpe.
So do you think you could meet the demand for the medical and space uses in the UK?
Yes. We were awarded last year some funding from the UK Space Agency to install an extraction capability at our facility up at Sellafield for americium extraction, and that has a nominal capacity of about 0.5 kilogram per year. So, you know, that therefore matches the kind of 2 or 3 units a decade. The amount of americium that's contained within legacy material at Sellafield is in the order of a few tons. So we will not be short of potential access to that material. On the medical isotope side of things, we again have capability we've installed at our facility down at Preston on the Springfields site, where we're able to access sufficient quantities of source material to get out the valuable isotopes that we need there. And again, the inventories of material we're going after or have identified are more than sufficient to meet the needs that we've identified. The other good thing that people forget to a certain extent with radioactive material is it's radioactive. So once you've taken the material out that you wanted, more grows back in because it's coming from a decay chain. So in some cases, we can process the material, the legacy material, take the isotope out, put it back on the shelf for 2 or 3 years, and then go back and do it all again because the same quantity of material has grown back into it. It's almost a perpetual circle in that respect.
Fascinating. So you're already getting the space stuff?
Yes, we've demonstrated we can do it. The Nuclear Decommissioning Authority has been very kind to let us access some of their stocks of legacy material, and we've extracted a number of grams of americium that's allowed us to do the test work. And we have our first mission identified for launch in 2028 on the Rosalind Franklin mission to Mars. So hopefully by the end of the decade, I'll be able to stand in the back garden and look at the red dot in the sky, knowing that some of our material from Sellafield is now keeping a spacecraft alive on that planet, which I think is a pretty inspirational thing to be doing.
That is quite something. On the medical side of things, it's not just where you are getting the material from, it's how they're being used that is equally pioneering.
They're very new. They are in early stage clinical trials at the moment. At the moment, there's only one drug on the market that uses this type of technique and uses an isotope of radium called 223 in its treatment to treat bone cancers. The next step of that are drugs based on isotopes of lead called 212 or actinium of isotope 225. And they're currently in early stage clinical trials and are showing great promise. It really is quite amazing. As a nuclear engineer rather than a medical person, when I see the pictures of a patient before and after treatment, and you can see that the cancers have vanished, all of the cancers have vanished, it's quite incredible. And I've certainly heard clinicians talking about this as being a miracle cure for late-stage cancers. So those cancers that have really spread within the body, because the technique can go and find them, it's not a surgical intervention. It literally goes, finds every cell of the cancer in the body. So it's really, really good for those for treatment where the cancer is spread into multiple places in the body.
That sounds really promising, and hopefully that will help with the political decisions that will be needed to allow it to happen. Given that the NDA's primary mission is the safe and secure storage and disposal of legacy material. It also raises a question about new things being discovered. And as time goes on, is there a possibility, do you think, of further value being discovered in this material?
I think that I wouldn't want to be in the political space having to make that decision, because I think it's really, really difficult. As a local resident to near Sellafield, I'm rather keen that the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority does focus on the safe decommissioning of the legacy and making sure that the material under its stewardship is in a very, very safe, managed form. On the other hand, I totally agree with you. The things that we have today, you know, 20 years ago, we weren't worrying about. So we didn't have things like mobile phones or electric cars. So we weren't worrying about some of the materials that are now going into those. And it's very, very likely the way technology develops that we don't know what in 10, 20, 30 years or more is going to be a valuable material that currently we are disposing of. I've seen reports of people starting to look at digging back up conventional waste landfills to try to get at the old batteries and materials that we threw away back then. And I do worry that when I'm long gone, that future generations may be looking at some of these waste stores that we've safely disposed underground and creating mines to get back at the material, because it's now valuable for something else. Who knows? We might invite a warp engine or something that needs the legacy material that we currently consider a waste. So I think getting that balance right is really important. Clearly, we don't want to just become a hoarder and just have everything in a store. But equally, some of this material, you know, you can kind of have a sense that some of this material could be valuable, and therefore, if we can put it in a form that's retrievable at minimal extra cost, then that's probably the right thing to do.
So apart from what we've discussed so far, is there any other material being looked at?
There's a number of isotopes being looked at for medical applications in this new developing area, and that is triggering other interest in other isotopes that were kind of overlooked in the past, that suddenly, if you're able to treat the person with, say, an isotope of lead 212, then actually having an isotope of lead that gives a gamma signature that allows you to do imaging before and after becomes more attractive. And if you weren't treating the person with the lead, then you probably wouldn't be interested in that lead isotope with the gamma signature. So you do see a little bit of that, and there are a number of isotopes that are being looked at, some of which do have to be made, some of which potentially can be obtained from legacy material. But this is just this developing area. I think what we're noticing in the UK is that university researchers have quite a lack of access to this material. We don't really make or do much of this work in the UK anymore. And so the university researchers are almost hampered by not having access to the material, and therefore can't develop new treatments. What we're trying to do is kind of hold a bit of a mirror up and say, look, here's a whole load of legacy material here. There's a whole load of researchers that want to try things. How can we bring the two together and see whether actually there's gold in them hills in terms of the legacy material?
And as mentioned, there has been grant funding for the work.
Yes, there was 10 successful grants. There was a lot of academic engagement in that. We're also engaged in a number of networks and hubs and groups around that bring together academic, industry, national labs together to try to act as an incubator for some of this innovation. And the UK is, you know, has got so much potential in this area. We punch very much above our weight in terms of the kind of biomedical drug development research. We also have a phenomenally good nuclear industry and a lot of incredibly skilled people. So bringing those two elements together from two very different sectors creates a really quite innovative partnership that might flow back the other way. We might discover biological systems that actually can help in decommissioning activities that we want to do, that are able to recover and retain or allow us to separate nuclear material and make it safer for eventual disposal.
Those are really interesting developments on both the space and the medical side of things. Is there any other research that you're involved in that's relevant?
I think that little knot keeps me very busy. The National Lab has a lot of interest spanning across the nuclear fission area. There's a lot of fascinating work going on, and I would encourage anybody with an interest in nuclear fission to check out our website or to interact with my colleagues from the lab at events. There's a lot of really interesting stuff. It's not all about decommissioning. Decommissioning is incredibly important, but we also have to look to the future and look to how we're going to provide clean energy domestically and across the world, and how we're going to exploit the benefit that we have with nuclear technology. It's not all scary. Unfortunately, people tend to be very scared of nuclear. It's not all scary.
So we're hopefully going to see a space mission partly fueled from the UK's legacy waste heading off to Mars in 2028.
Yeah, and then hopefully the lunar surface in the early 2030s. So it is exciting. It's great for engaging with early careers and universities and schools and researchers, etc., because it's a very tangible and kind of endpoint almost on the project that people can associate with. Space is interesting. I was just listening to the radio this morning, and Tim Peake had been on talking about him coming out of retirement to lead a UK team in of astronauts into space. To have that on like primetime radio shows you the impact that space has.
That's definitely something to be looking forward to. Many thanks for your time. It's been fascinating talking to you.
You're welcome.
Well, that's about all that we have time for. Don't forget to check out our show notes for links to further information about the topics covered, as well as a link to sign up to our daily and weekly email newsletters. And do feel free to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, so you don't miss out on the next edition of the World Nuclear News.